Right now, the American healthcare system is starting to feel the effects of the changes Washington policymakers put in place earlier in the year. It's all because of what President Trump called the one big beautiful bill. This year, we heard from Bill's supporters and skeptics, Margaret.
As I talk about a role of chief problem solver, yeah. That is front and center for us at CMS, given a large part of the reforms in One Big Beautiful Bill are really focused on things that we will pick up the baton from Congress once they pass a bill. And most of those are in Medicaid.
And who can forget the six-week government shutdown? It was largely over healthcare, and healthcare stakeholders were very concerned as it dragged on. What would it mean for families and patients who depend on the government for their healthcare?
First and foremost, I would encourage them to think about the families that are being impacted. And certainly there are issues that are a part of the shutdown or a part of the negotiation that are going to impact about 20 to 22 million families. There are issues that need to be discussed and resolved that impact affordability and access to healthcare.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome back to everyone to Conversations on Healthcare and our 2025 Rewind, as well as our Look Ahead program. Much of the healthcare news this year dealt with something that happened on July 4th. That's when President Trump signed the, as he called it, the one big beautiful bill into law. I think Nancy Pelosi might have called it something else. And its technical name is HR1. The legislation cuts $900 billion over 10 years from the Medicaid program. Shortly before Congress voted for the plan, we spoke to Stephanie Carlton, the Deputy Administrator and Chief of Staff at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Margaret, our interview there took place at Aspen Health Ideas, and she explained the administration's perspective on why such large reduction is needed, even as experts predicted that it could lead to 10 million more people becoming uninsured.
One is the work requirements. And as we think about work requirements, they're asking folks to really engage in their communities if they're receiving benefits through the Medicaid program. And that could take several different forms. One could be getting a job. Another could be volunteering in their communities. Another could be education, retraining for a job that they're interested in. But the idea is, how do we get people to engage with their communities? And we really believe that is something that is good for humans. It's good for us to engage with our fellow human beings. It's good for us to have a way that we demonstrate and feel purpose in our lives. And so we think this is a major reform in it. It's not a new concept, to be honest. This is something that President Clinton worked with Speaker Newt Gingrich on back in the 90s to do those kinds of reforms in other federal programs like the welfare program or what's now called TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. And so this is something we've seen over the last several decades make a difference in people's lives, and we think it's something important to bring to Medicaid. So that's what I would say is the first major part of the Medicaid reforms. A second is something that applies both to Medicaid and to the exchanges, the programs that we administer through SSIO. And that's just making sure that we've got the right folks on these programs. We are committed to really delivering benefits to those who are truly eligible. But there's a lot of things that during the COVID pandemic that we just didn't do as a government. An example of that would be asking folks to share documentation that their income level is what they say it is. This isn't a crazy new ask. It's something that has been part of a lot of federal programs to determine eligibility that we are restoring to both Medicaid and exchange subsidies as part of these reforms, just to make sure that the people who really need those programs are the ones that we are signing up and enrolling. In fact, on the insurance side of things, when we came in January, we noticed there was a lot of folks that were enrolling in the marketplace exchanges that found out they were enrolled after they'd been on the plan for a year. Think about that for a second. They actually found out when IRS sent them a note saying, hey, we need you to reconcile your income with the subsidies that you were getting. And that's something that's hard for a consumer to get surprised, and they didn't actually benefit from being on health insurance the year before that. And that's not how anyone designed those programs to work. And so we think about that as just restoring common sense to how we sign people up for those programs, because we want them to work for the people that are truly eligible for those benefits. A third major piece is around making sure that we target payments to providers that participate in the program well. Through Medicaid-managed care, managed care companies will set up networks. They will determine payment amounts with providers. And then they are responsible to make sure that the networks are adequate for the people who need that care. There's more we could do to make sure that is working well, but we have a process set up for that. And then through various changes over the years, there have been these things called state-directed payments that have been added on top of that process. The goal at the beginning, you know, came from a good place, which was to say the states want to add extra payments for providers that are doing interesting things on quality. That's really how it started. Although when we started looking at the data, there's only half of the states that were complying with the quality plans that they were committing to us to do. So it wasn't really fulfilling the quality objective. And then what happened during the Biden administration is those rates added up to commercial rates, or they were allowed to go up to commercial rates. And states are at varying levels towards that cap called the average commercial rate. But as we sat back and looked at it and said, well, you know, these are providers who are committing to society, to vulnerable Americans, that they're going to help with their healthcare needs. And we have historically paid them at Medicaid rates or often up to Medicare rates. But paying up to commercial rates kind of changes the focus of the program, where it becomes more about facilities profiting more than making sure patients are taken good care of. And so that's what we've said. Hey, we still want to pay appropriately, but Medicare is a better cap on those payment rates than commercial rates. Mm-hmm. So that's really the third big area. And then, Margaret, to your question, and to Mark's, what will CMS has to do should Congress pass that bill? We're going to be real busy real soon doing the implementation of that.
You know, we're recording this now, and people may hear it after the bill's been passed, but the House and Senate are still working on the legislation. We had the opportunity to talk with Governor Sununu just a few minutes ago, listen to him, and former governor of New Hampshire, Republican, and who was worried about the responsibilities that states will have financially with the new bill. And again, it's still in the works. The Senate has a draft. The House has passed a version at this point. Just worried about whether or not there's a financial capability at the state level. And I'm wondering, sort of, not to get into the details of your conversations with governors, but I'm sure there's some anxiety because it seems like some of what's happening, at least in the House and the Senate, that you'll have to administer is some real shift of responsibility in terms of things that won't be there in terms of reductions that the states will have to address all at once. And I'm wondering how you think that needle is going to be thread, and are you having those conversations now with states about trying to just understand what their financial responsibilities will be if the program is reduced?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. Anytime you make changes to Medicaid, governors start asking a lot of questions, and they ask hard questions, and they're good questions mm-hmm. that we need to be ready to answer. And so absolutely, we've spent a lot of time talking to governors, to state health secretaries, and to state Medicaid directors about the implications of this. And the implications really do depend on which part of the bill we're talking about. So on work requirements, that is something we would partner with the states on implementing. We believe that we could do that in very different ways than it's been tried before. using technology solutions that are much quicker to implement and that are much more consumer friendly to implement. Yeah. But that's something we will work in partnership with the states.
Is that because people have said the administrative burden might be too great for the states to manage?
And that's where we say, look, it is 2025. Technology allows you to do things differently and much more quickly, and in a way that, you know, consumers use their smartphones for all kinds of things. And if we're able to develop a solution with states, with governors, that is very easy for states to get up and running, and that's much easier for consumers to use, we address those administrative burdens in a way that really achieves the intent, which is how do we get people engaging with their communities, which is really a good thing for humans to be doing. So that's one area. That is something that the information technology funding, there's a lot that's available. So that wouldn't be a big new burden on the states. We actually match IT at 90%, which is much higher than the match for the rest of the Medicaid program. So we don't anticipate that being a big financial burden on the states. It's a partnership we will do with them. Second, is usually where we get questions, which is around the state-directed payments that I was mentioning. And there, it's not something that directly some would frame it as pushing burden back on the states. It's something that lowers the rates that go to providers like hospitals. And so that's something that could actually bring down the state costs and is designed at lowering care and making sure that the payments that we send to providers in the Medicaid program is appropriate. And that actually reduces the state share as well as the federal share. And so something that we think is much more reasonable. And then same thing kind of happens on the eligibility side when we're asking states to be more diligent and request the appropriate documentation for who they're signing up in the program. And that's also something when you get the right folks enrolled on the program, you're really targeting resources to those who need it most. And that's not about shifting costs to the federal or state government. That's about making sure scarce resources are targeted. But I will step back and make a macro point. We looked at the data. And there's a lot of the original deal, if you will, between the states and the federal government that has changed, where the federal government committed a certain percentage. It varies by states, but it's typically, it could be as low as 50% and as high as in the mid-70s to states. And through various things like provider taxes, and this is usually where it comes, they're sort of backdoor gimmicks. There's some folks that would use a much stronger term like money laundering, where that kind of a process pushes or shifts responsibility to the federal government, which is not the original deal that the federal government had with states and how we co-invest in the Medicaid program. And I think that's important just to keep in mind, where we need both states and the federal government to live up to the original bargain, if you will.
While all of us in healthcare were closely watching these developments, so was KFF Health News Chief Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner. During the middle of the legislative fight, she explained the intense negotiations that were going on.
There's a growing group of Republicans who are unhappy with how many reductions there are to the Medicaid program, because Medicaid really over the last decade or so has sort of ceased to be an, you know, inner city urban health program and become much more of a support for rural areas and for people who voted for the Republicans and President Trump. You have Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, not someone I had on my bingo card, as, you know, a huge supporter of Medicaid, basically jumping up and down and saying we should not cut Medicaid. It's a bad idea. Of course, Missouri is one of those states that added the Medicaid coverage as part of its state constitution. So if the federal government stops paying as much for it, Missouri is really stuck paying for that itself, which I think has something to do with Senator Hawley's resistance right now. But there's a lot of resistance in a lot of places, and we'll see if they can overcome it. I honestly have no idea. I know the pressure to, you know, do what the president wants in the Republican Party is extremely strong, but there are a lot of members who've been talking about a lot of these things, like the, you know, state and local tax deductions, for quite a long time, and they don't look ready to throw it in either. So we'll see.
Of course, ultimately, President Trump and the Republicans were victorious. That means states that expanded Medicaid are already seeing their federal matching funds gradually decrease in this current fiscal year. But the Republican success only fortified Democrats in their belief that they needed to stand up for their policy views. They found the opportunity to do so in the fall by saying any federal budget agreement needed to include an extension of Obamacare subsidies. The impasse, as we all know, Margaret, led to the closing of the federal government for 43 days, the longest shutdown in U.S. history. We heard from a number of guests about what it meant that the people they serve. First, American Academy of Family Physicians CEO Sean Martin.
First and foremost, I would encourage them to think about the families that are being impacted. And certainly there are issues that are a part of the shutdown or a part of the negotiation that are going to impact about 20 to 22 million families. There are issues that need to be discussed and resolved that impact affordability and access to healthcare. But I think the message we continue to convey is that those discussions need to take place in a bipartisan way. But they also need to take the appropriate steps to make sure American families aren't significantly hurt or impacted. And food insecurity, making food insecurity worse, is not a means to a better tomorrow for a lot of families.
Well, legislation that was tied to the budget impasse also meant Medicare telehealth flexibilities and the acute hospital care at home program expired. Kyle Zebley, the then senior vice president of public policy at the American Telemedicine Association, told us what was at stake because of this.
These flexibilities, the acute hospital care at home program, were put in place by President Trump, have been kept in place ever since the beginning of the pandemic on a bipartisan basis through the Biden-Harris administration, have already been renewed once by President Trump in his second stint in office. We are deeply concerned that even though we're not a spending provision, we have been attached to spending bills that we're going to lapse for that first time since the onset of the pandemic. The stakes are enormous. We're talking about millions of Americans through the Medicare program having access to telehealth services or benefiting from the forward-reaching visionary program, the acute hospital care at home program, benefiting from these items that will lose out starting just early tomorrow morning, right around 12:01 a.m. and thereafter. It's a tremendous setback for our community. It's all the more disappointing because these are popular bipartisan provisions. I think it is unfortunately emblematic of the dysfunction that we've seen in Washington, D.C. now for many years running. As I often have said, it's everybody's fault. It's nobody's fault. These are really good men and women. We're honored and don't take for granted the fact that our program's priorities are bipartisan and popular. But if we, in particular, in this rarefied space of clear agreement, are in a position where we're only hours away from expiration, something is deeply wrong with how Congress and the federal government operate. And it's a real shame. And I say that as somebody that's, you know, been in Washington, D.C. and always been honored to do so for 16 years. But it's a real shame that it's come to this.
Margaret, I don't think we boosted his career, but congratulations to Kyle as he was named the CEO of ATA shortly after our interview. The shutdown also affected the federal drug discount program known as 340B. Reporter William Newton of 340B Report explained how the impasse delayed approvals for a federal rebate pilot and furloughed key staff.
We know that a significant percentage of HHS staff has been furloughed. The site that basically the database of covered entities and manufacturers in the 340B program is operational, but it has a message saying that it's not being regularly updated due to the lapse in funding. So there are a lot of big question marks, but certainly it seems pretty unclear whether or not HRSA is going to stay in schedule for this rebate experiment.
Well, Mark, I almost hate to mention this at this time of year, but there is a risk of another shutdown at the end of January. And as of right now, there just is no solution to the Obamacare subsidy question. Those tax credits expire at the end of the year. We'll certainly be waiting for any news out of Washington. But as Washington fought over the future of healthcare funding, Americans also recognize 2025 as the 60th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid. That's a pretty landmark anniversary
really
for
is.
People who
really
follow health policy and healthcare in the United States. Mark Updegrove is the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation and a presidential historian for ABC News. He shared his thoughts about the anniversary and the impact of these programs on life in the United States.
In 1965, one-third of America's population over 65 lived in poverty. LBJ, among other things, is known for the war on poverty, the war he waged on poverty in our nation. And one of those things necessitated ensuring that Americans who couldn't afford the most basic health care needs could do so through an insurance policy allowed through Medicare. And so it's something that Harry Truman had tried to push up the hill, wasn't able to do so. John F. Kennedy did so as well. But Lyndon Johnson got it done in 1965, and it's been woven into the fabric of our country ever since.
Well, let's set the scene by talking a little bit about what was happening in the country six decades ago. Those were interesting times, just like these are interesting times. The U.S. had just elected Lyndon Johnson as president in his own right following John F. Kennedy's assassination. He was really at the height of his political power in a long political life. Tell us, who was he at that point, as you've come to know and understand him through history?
You know, you're absolutely right, Margaret. 1965 is the high tide of the Great Society and of the Johnson administration. He, of course, takes over as president in the wake of the assassination of John F. Kennedy on November 22nd, 1963. He rides out that year as an accidental president, becomes elected in his own right. In 1964, with the largest electoral mandate in American history, 61% of the popular vote, rides into the White House with this mandate, and he knows the ephemeral nature of political capital. So he uses 1965 to get as much done as he possibly can. And during the course of that year, you see the creation of Head Start and VISTA, and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Highway Beautification Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Immigration Act, the most sweeping immigration reform in the history of our country, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the Higher Education Act, the Voting Rights Act, and the creation of Medicare and Medicaid.
Wow.
And that is one year.
Wow.
Of the Johnson presidency is stunning.
Well, you know, Margaret, I had the chance to read Robert Caro's four books on Johnson, and Mark, you know, he really was able to use his political strength to push through so many things, but in particular, the federal health insurance program. And that, as you said earlier, that was really a legacy that others had tried to get through. How did he do it?
You know, let me just go back for a moment and mention again that Truman had really pushed hard for this.
Yeah.
And I think you had the resistance of the medical community, the doctors in particular. They thought they were going to lose money if you went to a federal, you know, what they considered social medicine. John F. Kennedy, the year of his death, had a huge rally at Madison Square Garden to push for Medicare. Lyndon Johnson did it for a number of reasons. Number one, he was a student of power. I think he understood intrinsically the way that power worked, and he could work on lawmakers in a way that Harry Truman and John F. Kennedy could not. He just had this great ability to get things done. Number two, I think it was an idea whose time had come. You had two-thirds majorities, Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate. And there was this confluence of circumstances, rather, that made it possible for progressive reform like that to go into place, despite the violent resistance of so many Republicans, and including a Republican named Ronald Reagan, who had yet to be the governor of California and president of the United States, but was a very active voice in the Republican Party, and said that it would be the ruin of America to see something like Medicare and Medicaid go through. It would lead to greater socialism in our nation.
Well, Margaret, that took us back to 1965, and that really was a monumental year, just as this one has been. We'll continue our 2025 rewind next week by looking at the progress of long COVID diagnosis and treatment and where things are headed, exploring the technology innovations that's occurring in the healthcare field, and hearing again from some famous names from healthcare causes that matter to them.
So just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X with our account name, CHC Radio. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for our email updates, and please also share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Happy holidays, Happy New Year. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.